the Soccer Central podcast. Once again, Monday edition. James Sharman here alongside John Molinaro. Pretty good weekend of football. Some fascinating results. And of course, the Champions League draw that went hours ago, really early. Jamie, were you up at 6 a.m.
No.
watching that thing?
No.
You weren't? I thought that you'd be the one guy who get up at 6 in the morning to watch that.
No, 6 a.m.
Awful, isn't it? Unholy. Unholy time. Well, we'll get to that very shortly. Also today, we'll talk with Paolo Bandini about the Italian Serie A, what's happening there this season. I have some questions about the Milan teams in particular. We'll get to Paolo in about 20 minutes' time. But to start with, let's talk about this Champions League draw with Graham Ruthven. Graham, how you doing, mate?
Hello. I'm good, James. How are you?
Excellent, thank you. So here's the matchups in the last 16 draw. PSG-Chelsea, Man City-Barcelona, Leverkusen, Atletico Madrid, Juventus, Dortmund, Schalke, Real Madrid, Shakhtar Donetsk, Bayern Munich, Arsenal, Monaco, and Basel, Porto. Who is the most unhappy club on this day?
I think in one answer, Manchester City. I think they got the team that they didn't want. Second time in 2 years that they've got Barcelona at this stage of the tournament, and after scraping through the group stages, a team of Barcelona's caliber was the kind of team they wanted to avoid.
There's a couple of marquee matches, Graham. Which one do you think you're most looking forward to? Which one do you think has the most, sexiness, for lack of a better word?
Well, I think there's always a sex appeal when you're talking about Zlatan Ibrahimovic, so I'll go with PSG against Chelsea. And I know I'm kind of contradicting myself by saying that the Man City-Barcelona game is slightly mundane because they played each other last year, but I think the way the two teams, PSG and Chelsea, have developed over the last year makes that a really interesting tie, the way that Chelsea have progressed under Jose Mourinho and the way that maybe PSG have sort of gone backwards under Laurent Blanc this season. So that's a really interesting tie for me.
Yeah, for sure. And Chelsea, of course, last year prevailed on away goals. Now, looking at that match a bit closer here, PSG, they need to make a dent in European football. They've committed so many resources to this team. And as you mentioned, the last couple of years have been dominant in French football. This year, not playing at the same level, but they have to break through, don't they, in the European stage at some point?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, James. That's the success with which, or the failure, rather, that Laurent Blanc will be judged upon. It's what defines PSG, of course. They've got a stranglehold over the French league, and it's in the Champions League where the real measure of their success is held. And if you're to believe reports, the club owners have actually told Laurent Blanc that he needs to make the semi-finals this season to keep his job. That's the benchmark they're holding against him. So a very tough draw for PSG. They haven't had the best of seasons so far. But in the past, they have actually turned up in the Champions League. They pushed Barcelona a couple of years ago very hard. They pushed Chelsea, of course, last season. So I think there is something for them to build upon in Europe there.
We're talking to Graham Ruthven, BN Sports contributor here on the Soccer Central podcast. Graham, is there a team in the round of 16 that you wouldn't want to face? I wrote about this last week saying, you know, Atletico Madrid, not too many people are talking about them. 5 clean sheets in a row, won a somewhat difficult group. And that, you know, if I'm Bayern or Chelsea, I'm pretty happy that they're finished group winners as well. So, you know, they avoided playing them. Is there a team like Atletico Madrid, or is it Atletico Madrid, that you kind of look at that are flying a little bit under the radar?
Well, you're right to point out Atletico Madrid, John. I think, although they haven't had all their own way in La Liga this season, I think that you're right. They've shut up shop in the Champions League. They've got a very strong defence, probably the strongest back line in all of European football at the moment. And I think, although the obvious answer is maybe Real Madrid, who are 20 games winning streak at the moment, they're obviously the team that you look at them and you think, well, they could rip apart everyone in this tournament. However, Atletico Madrid are such a difficult team to play against. Simeone has them dogged for every single game, every ball they chase after. And they haven't really lost that quality either. They're maybe not scoring as many goals as they were last season with Diego Costa signing for Chelsea, but they are certainly, in terms of the personality, the same side as last season. And you're right, I think that they'll be a difficult outfit for anyone to face in this last 16.
One that stands out to me is Juventus Borussia Dortmund. Now, Juve, as we know, once again, great in the Italian Serie A. I really like this team. I think in many ways they're underserved playing in Italy right now in a pretty weak Serie A, because that team, the midfield in particular, is one of the best in Europe. But they're playing a Dortmund team who, it looks to me like the master plan is working beautifully. You know, lull all the opponents into this false sense of security. Let's play awful football for the first 3 months of the season and then pounce once the German break ends. You know, this Dortmund team, they really are the great enigma of European football right now. Any chance they can rediscover their form and test Juventus?
Well, if their plan for this season is to win, to qualify for the next season's Champions League by winning the Champions League, well, they're doing quite well on that front so far. As you say, not very impressive at all in the Bundesliga this season. However, they have reserved their best form for this competition, and certainly I think I can see them going far. Juventus are almost in the same kind of boat as a team like PSG, who by their success or failure is defined by what they do in the Champions League because of their slightly weaker domestic league. So, and Juventus have found in recent seasons it's difficult to raise your game to a higher level against better opposition when you're maybe not being tested to the same level domestically. So this tie is very interesting as well. I actually kind of forgot about this one when you asked me which one grabbed my attention. I might actually answer this tie because the juxtaposition between the two teams is really compelling and one that I'll certainly be keeping an eye on.
Is there a certain amount of luck involved here, Graham? I mean, when you look at the draw in terms of, you know, teams like Bayern and Real, both group winners, and they get, I won't say walkovers, but relatively easy games in Shakhtar Donetsk and Schalke, whereas Barca and Chelsea, who also won their group, you know, they get Man City and PSG, which are, I think, fair to say that those are incredibly tougher, much more difficult groups. Maybe you could speak to about, you know, the element of luck that is needed to win this tournament.
Absolutely, and I think the seeding system and the draw in the Champions League and in other tournaments as well has always favoured the bigger teams, the better teams. However, that relies on the competition going to form. So if you have a bigger team finishing in second place, then that throws it out of sync a little bit, and that's what's happened with Manchester City and Barcelona, and their seedings is not quite up to their standards of the team. And that's how you get these quality of last 16 ties. And I suppose I'm actually quite thankful for that. That's what makes this stage of the tournament interesting. Of course, if you had just a favourite, a clear favourite, and a clear underdog in every game, it maybe wouldn't be as interesting. But yeah, you're absolutely right, John. It does seem a little bit unfair at times, but I'm thankful for that, to be honest.
No, I would agree. It certainly adds to the intrigue of the tournament. And speaking of luck, I mean, Arsenal has kind of bemoaned its luck with regards to the draw in past years. You know, it's gotten teams like Barcelona and Bayern, but I would have to think Arsene Wenger pretty happy, or relatively happy, so to speak, that they drew Monaco.
Yes, absolutely. It's their first decent draw at this stage of the tournament for quite some time, and I was actually watching the draw with an Arsenal fan today, and he was basically resigned to the fact that they'd get Bayern Munich again this season as well. but he was quite pleased with Monaco. And of course, they will be favourites for that game, although Arsenal are maybe going through a bit of a mini-crisis, although I'm not quite sure if anyone is sure if they're going through a mini-crisis. One week it seems to be yes, and one week no, but they will be favourites for this game, heavy favourites. I can't see them crashing out at this stage.
Looking at the overall favourites, you mentioned obviously Real Madrid, Bayern Munich. You have to, I guess, throw Barcelona in there, and maybe Chelsea. Do you see any team outside those four teams legitimately winning this thing?
I wish I did, James. I really do, and I'd love a team like Atletico Madrid to come through again. I think Atletico Madrid will be difficult to beat, but do they have the quality to beat those four teams you've just mentioned? I'm not so sure. I think the winner will come from those four teams, and I'm glad you mentioned Chelsea. Some people would actually have you believe that it's only three teams that can win the Champions League, and Chelsea are not one of those teams. I think they are in that top tier of challengers. But I mean, this is maybe the effect of FFP coming in now. It's maybe having the opposite effect. It's preserving the status quo and keeping the top teams at the very top. I think the winners will come from those four teams you mentioned.
I look forward to hearing Jose Mourinho build up this game as, you know, the haves and the have-nots of European football. You know, he's going to mention some nonsense about that, certainly.
Or the ball boys.
Or the ball boys, yeah, that as well. Before we leave, Graham, got to ask you, you're based in Glasgow in the Europa League. Celtic have been drawn with Inter Milan. What's the thought in those parts right now about that matchup? It's pretty juicy.
Yeah, probably the best draw that Celtic could have got out of it at this stage of the tournament. Maybe not in terms of the prospects of progressing. Inter Milan will certainly be the favourites for that game, but it's a romantic tie for Celtic. Of course, they won the European Cup in 1967 in Lisbon, the famous Lisbon Lions, and they played Inter Milan. So I expect there will be a lot of build-up for that game and a lot of anticipation. Of course, it is a game that Celtic have a chance in as well. Inter Milan are not the Italian juggernauts they once were. They're struggling this season. I think they've maybe only won four or five league games this season. They've switched managers. Walter Mazzarri is out. Roberto Mancini is in. So on all fronts, really, it's a very good draw for Celtic.
Absolutely is. Graham, thank you so much, mate. We've got many weeks to prepare for these games and build up the hype. But thanks so much. We'll chat to you very soon.
That's no problem at all, James. Anytime.
Thanks, James.
Graham, you mean?
Graham.
You
guys all sound alike.
Oh, my word. Graham would find great offense in that.
He probably would, actually. Yeah.
So he should. You can get all Graham's articles on grahamruthven.net. That's G-R-A-H-A-M, Ruthven, R-U-T-H-V-E-N.net. Yeah, I love this draw. I like to see some glamour tilts in the last 16.
I do, too. It's just a shame in one regard that, you know, two of Barcelona, Man City, PSG, and Chelsea are going to be gone after the second round. I don't get me wrong. I think those are fantastic matchups, and, you know, I'm grateful to see them at any stage. But, you know, the fact that two of them will be gone relatively soon, a little disappointed about that. But that's the way it goes.
What do you think the reaction was inside Basel and Porto?
Oh, I'm sure they were, you know,
dancing
in the streets. Yeah,
my word.
That's pretty sweet for both sides, I would think. And they're really, I mean, that could really go either way. And people are going to write off Basel, but...
Sure, at your peril, I would say.
Yeah, they are a good team, and they've played English teams very well in recent years in Europe, as Liverpool and Chelsea found out to their dismay. So, yeah, that's certainly an interesting one. Probably, like, the most even one,
One
of them, anyway.
Yeah, PSG, Chelsea, very even on paper, at least. But if you look at this team, these teams at this point this season compared to last season... When Chelsea beat PSG last season, PSG is pretty much the same team,
yes,
give or take. Chelsea, as we know, it is quite different with two, you know, enormous parts added since last season. So they're a far better side than they were this time last year. And bear in mind also that these games go after the January transfer window.
That's true too.
There could be some changes. Now, obviously, top players, generally speaking, don't move in January because they're already playing the top teams in the Champions League.
Right.
But you might see some big names moved, and I know Chelsea say that they're not going to spend anything in the window, but they do need some depth. I think that's obvious.
I think there was, you take this with a grain of salt, but I think there was recent reports that they might actually bring back Fernando Torres.
Why would they do that? That's
I don't know.
Absolute nonsense, isn't it?
Well,
what would you?
You need depth.
I know you need depth, but you need good players too.
Yeah.
Well. And he's... Torres almost symbolizes Chelsea's relative struggles, right, in recent years. Why bring him back?
But, you know what, for all his criticism, I seem to think that, and maybe I'm overstating this, but he has done fairly well for Chelsea in Europe anyway. I mean, I remember him scoring against Barcelona against that one year. He scored some pretty, important goals. So, I don't know.
One goal this year for AC Milan.
Yeah. Certainly not lighting it up in Serie A.
There's also, I saw a stupid report about him heading back to Liverpool as well. They could do with a striker.
Well, they could do with a striker. I mean, wouldn't that be something?
Don't do it. You know, I think most Liverpool fans have wonderful memories of El Nino in red. Let's keep that memory.
Yeah.
Let's not replace it with the current El Nino.
I was thinking about this the other day, James. Have you ever remembered a player who was kind of on top of the world as much as he was, and then following a transfer, just never really... You know, just went down so quickly,
Maybe Shevchenko.
Yeah, although I tend to think he was probably towards the end of his... He He was already sort of, you know, I think at the beginning of, you know, the downward spiral.
Yeah, but if you,
that
if
wasn't
you
the case with
it,
Torres.
Well, you say that, but if you look at the last few months at Liverpool, he wasn't very good.
His legs had gone. No, absolutely. But he was still in the prime of his career in terms of an age perspective.
Age-wise, yeah, yeah. Sure.
I don't think the same could be said for Shevchenko.
He got old very quickly, didn't he?
He certainly did. I mean,
I'm trying to think who else would be a similar. I mean, when Juan Verón left Lazio.
Ooh, that's actually very good. Yeah.
Because he was arguably, some would consider, the most important player in world football at that point.
He was incredible. He was certainly one of the best midfielders in the world at the time. Yeah, I don't think there's that's any exaggeration. I totally forgot about that. Yeah, that's a good one too. But I think with just Torres being, you know, a goal scorer, I think it's just more pronounced, right? Because, you know, they're judged by how many times they put the ball in the back of the net.
Yeah, you go from 30 to 3.
Right.
Or whatever it was, you know, it's incredible. Did you catch the Manchester United destruction of Liverpool 3-0?
Well, you say destruction. I think 3-0 rather flattered United, to be perfectly frank, because Mata's goal was offside. One of them, was it the RVP goal? That was the gift from Lovren. Oh my God, what a terrible clearance.
I'm pretty sure Lovren's got a twin brother.
Yeah, we were talking about that before the show.
Somewhere in some Caribbean island, the Dejan Lovren is enjoying himself, enjoying his riches in semi-retirement, and his crap brother is playing for Liverpool.
Do you have, because he was, I don't think it's any exaggeration to say he was one of the best centre-backs in the Premier League. Do you have a theory as to why he's been so underperforming for Liverpool this year?
No.
Just one of those things.
Yeah. Because, I mean, he's making blatant mistakes.
Yeah.
That's a problem. He has zero confidence. He was given much of the first half of the season, you know, to prove himself.
Right.
Right. Even when he was playing badly, Roger stuck with him to start the season. Only in recent weeks has he been dropped.
Right.
I don't know what it is. I mean, he kind of came from nowhere as well.
He did.
Southampton had that great year, but have defenders figured him out? Because it's not like they're tactically better. He's just making egregious errors on a regular basis. So it's a confidence issue. I don't know what it is.
We've talked about it before that sometimes, you know, it just takes a while for a player to bed in, you know, when they transfer from one club to another.
But it's within the same league, though, right?
It is.
It's not as if you can use that as an excuse.
No, it is, but you know what? And I'll cite this example again. I remember when Juventus bought Pavel Nedved from Lazio, who was lights out for Lazio, and then it took him, you know, a couple months for him to really become the Pavel Nedved of Lazio at Juventus. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it just the change in form from last year compared to this season from Lovren's it's striking.
It's incredible, though. You're right. Liverpool didn't play that badly, actually.
No.
De Gea was once again brilliant.
Wonderful.
And United win 6 straight games playing very average football, but relying on great goalkeeping. And that's not my bias coming out here. Most people agree. If you look at their last 6 results, they have not been their complete performances. Now, taking nothing away from them, well done. You know, you're cemented in the top 4 in a very weak year.
Yep.
But it's just typical that it's United that, as they go through a very rocky transition, they still find a way to pick up points and sit back in that top 4 spot, which could really accelerate this transitional phase if they can get Champions League football so early. Because I don't see them at this point dropping out. You know, I look at the teams and what they're doing behind them, and I think Arsenal will get in there eventually.
Yeah.
I think United aren't getting any worse. No, they'll be out.
You think so?
Yeah.
Well,
for sure.
Yeah.
It's going to be City, Chelsea, not in this order.
Right.
So if you want order, Chelsea, City, Arsenal, United. It is. It always is up until last year, which is a freak year.
I'd be curious to see West Ham because I really like the way that they're playing. I think Allardyce has really set them up for success this year. So,
but you don't really think they're a top 4 team?
Potentially. Look, the way they're playing.
I hope you're right. I would love to see West Ham in the top four.
And I don't think, I mean, you know, you're right. I mean, it's great that if you're a United fan, you're probably pleased that they've managed to win 6 in a row without playing particularly well. Because I think, and this is a cliche, I know, and it's hardly original thought, but that's what great teams do. They find a way to win even when they're not playing well. But, I really wonder if they're going to be found out soon, you know, especially if come January, if they don't sort of bulk up and add some defenders.
Lots of rumors out there. Huidas, Hummels, basically any German defender are being linked with Manchester United. By the way, Brendan Rodgers finally drops Simone Mignolet for Brad Jones, who I think hasn't started in their league since I think it's March 2013.
Yeah, what'd you think of that?
Listen, Mignolet's been dreadful. I understand that. Wasn't awful, though, against Basel last week. So he picks this game to drop him against Manchester United? I just wonder about that. I think Brendan Rodgers is once again overthinking things. If you're going to drop him 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know? And to put Brad Jones in that position, I think it's pretty unfair. He wasn't great, but it was hardly his fault they lost the game. I'm not putting it on Brad Jones. It just seems like Rodgers is just, I don't know, overthinking things right now.
And what does he do now? Does he stay with Jones? Does he go
back
to Mignolet?
Well, apparently Mignolet's been dropped indefinitely is the term they use. So
interesting.
Brad Jones is not a starting goalkeeper.
I wouldn't think so, not unless your starter is injured. Yeah, I would agree.
So January could be extremely important.
Could be.
For many reasons. Assume that Rodgers is still there. We'll find out about that. Chelsea beat Hull 2-0, of course. Lots of diving in this game. Actually, across the weekend, lots of diving. Embarrassing.
There was, yeah.
Tons.
Yeah. The Costa one was bad. The one, was it Sunderland? I can't remember.
West Ham.
The West Ham.
Johnson went down so easily.
God.
It was brutal. But in the Chelsea game of note was Costa got done for diving, which I thought was a bit harsh. He didn't try and sell it. It may have been, he's trying to avoid the lick. But just prior to that, Gary Cahill had gone arse over tit
too.
In the box. A terrible dive. And he was on a yellow card, should have been a yellow card, should have been off, and it wasn't.
But James, I thought English players didn't dive.
Oh, no, that's was the case maybe 15 years ago, but no,
they're certainly
just
up there
as willing
now.
To go down as any European, continental European players.
But you're right. I mean, this sort of weekend was, for me, it was marked by some like pretty some terrible dives, but soft penalty calls, too.
Yeah.
I mean, God, who was the one? I can't even remember, but there was one that I was just thought, oh my goodness, really? You're going to give a penalty for that? Jeez.
Well, I mean, that was a big one. The West Ham, Gomez
scored, that
obviously,
was...
when Johnson went down under Tompkins, right? That was a big one. I'm trying to think of the other penalties, what they were.
There's one or two other ones that I just thought, I don't know how you could really give that.
But... Mm-hmm. Arsenal went again, 4-1.
Yeah.
4-1.
Nice to see.
Giroud, 2 goals. Cthulhu, 2 goals. Sanchez, bossing it again?
Yeah, that sort of pass that he laid off for Giroud to open it, I thought that was just a great cross into the box. And, you know, it was a heavy touch that I think Giroud played Sanchez
over the right-hand side, that right corner.
So Sanchez had to, like, track it down and then sort of, you know, then he had to lay a cross into the box. So he did well, just great on that play. And you're just seeing what a well-rounded player Sanchez is, not just a goal scorer, but a goal provider.
And the fans were chanting for Arsene Wenger to
stay.
Well,
of course they were. It's a fickle business, as you said on the broadcast.
Jesus, J-Mo. What is it about Arsenal fans, though, more than others? They flip-flop.
Yeah.
Well. So quickly. Are you an Arsenal? I forget, actually. Are you a Wenger supporter? You respect him, obviously.
I respect
him. Should he stay? Should he go? I never actually asked you this question.
I certainly respect him. I do think it's probably time to go. I just think... Well, I've said this before. They just seem to be in this rut of complacency under Wenger, where you know finishing top four is seen as a successful season when they should be challenging for the title. And you know they made such a big deal last season about winning the FA Cup, which I guess. I mean, for me, that doesn't. I was hardly satisfied. You know, I wanted to see the way that you know the way the season was going in the first half. I thought you know they've got a shot at winning this. To settle for the FA Cup.
Still, when you get Ozil back in the new year and you get Koscielny back and you get Walcott back and you get 18 other injured players back, they're only going to get better.
Yeah, I still think this team lacks, I think, a little bit of grit and just physical presence in midfield. They've got wonderful attacking players, but I think they're attack heavy. They don't have enough grafters. They don't have enough
So what you're saying is they're going to go out in January and go and get Lee Catamol.
Well, that wouldn't be the worst move in the world.
Oh, it might be.
No, it would be.
It would be pretty bad.
But you know what I mean? I just think, like,
sure.
And I've said this before, I don't think they've ever truly replaced Patrick Vieira.
No, which isn't so easy.
No.
But
I
haven't tried to replace him. That's
what I mean. They haven't really gone out and you know, yeah. So, I mean.
Well, Craig made a great point in the weekend. Craig Forrest, he was saying that, you know, Wenger's never been a great motivator, but he's had great motivators in his teams, successful teams.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
So he's left it to the Vieiras and the Henrys and the, you know, Petits, Keones.
Right.
Real character players who can really get that room jumping. And who's leading that team now? Who's that guy?
Yeah,
isn't there, right?
Yeah. I think that these are more like a, if anything, it's more a group of like lead by example guys. I don't think there's anyone kind of standing out as, you know. as the leader on this group.
Amy Lawrence, she thinks she said in this show, and she's written about it before as well, how, you know, she thinks that Wenger just fell into the trap of Barcelona. He fell in love with that Barcelona system and style.
Right.
And wanted to duplicate it and won't budge. Whereas, you know, it's all very well doing that if you have Xavi, Iniesta,
and Messi.
Yeah. If you got, you know, Santi Cazorla, Jack Wiltshire.
These are all fine players.
Fine players.
But
not the type of players that can really carry a team.
Not like for a season, no.
Three players could. Shall we move on?
Sure.
Well, the Italian Serie A is similar to what it was this time last year. Juventus dominating, Roma not too far behind, but a nice little gap separating them and the rest. To break down the Serie A thus far, Paolo Bandini joins us once again. Hey, Paolo.
Hey, James. How are you?
Great, thank you. Before we get to the Serie A, actually, we're just talking with Graham Ruthven about the Champions League draw. And Juventus Dortmund really stands out as potentially, assuming Dortmund find their bloody form by then, as one of the tilts of the next round. What are your thoughts on the Juventus perspective?
I think from Juventus' perspective, it probably is one of those where, you know, it's not by any stretch of the imagination a draw that's easy. It's probably not even necessarily one which they're going to be favoured for, but it's probably about, it's not as positive as it's got to have gone, but it's certainly a positive draw for Juventus. I think if you look at the teams that won their groups, there were several who Juventus would have much rather avoid than Dortmund. It's strange. It's sort of harboured with Dortmund at the moment because they are so capable of more than they're showing. But, you know, having seen them at the beginning of the group stage play against Arsenal when they absolutely played them off the park, and then being at the Emirates Stadium for that second game, just a completely different team, not even a shadow of what they were. So if it's that Dortmund team that is, you know, still, if Dortmund is still in that place when it gets to February, when they come to play Juventus, and I think Juventus have a really, really good chance of getting through that game. But if it's the same Dortmund we saw at the beginning of the season or we saw last season, then it's a very different story.
Sticking with the Juventus theme, they dropped points in a 1-1 draw against Sampdoria on the weekend in Turin. Sampdoria ending Juve's 25-game winning streak at home in Serie A. This is a team that Juventus has struggled against in recent years, Paolo. Why does Sampdoria give the Bianconeri such a hard time?
Yeah, it's a good question. I was sort of thinking about earlier because when you look at it, the team has changed a lot, even since they, you know, because obviously it was Sampdoria who last beat Juventus at Juventus Stadium. It was 2-1. It was Mauro Icardi got both goals. It was one of the most improbable games you could imagine because Sampdoria were 1-0 down and down to 10 men before they started coming back into it. And that was in a season when they were a lower half of the table team. They weren't even a team as they are now that was pushing on towards Europe. So it's strange, but it is just one of those things that you could imagine being maybe a psychological thing for Juventus players. It just sneaks into their heads. But in terms of players, in terms of personnel, in terms of coaching, too much has changed at Sampdoria to really sort of draw a reasonable conclusion about, well, these guys, you know, just know how to, you know how to deal with Juventus players. It's a combination, I think, of coincidence and maybe a little bit of superstition that gets into players' heads more than we think sometimes.
And just to stay with Sampdoria, I mean, third in the table, quite impressive. How do you account for that? I mean, is this totally down to Mihailovic, or is there other forces at work here?
Yeah, and that's the other thing, right? You know, we can talk about them being the bestianiere of a team that Juve's bogey team, but just looking at the actual quality in that Sampdoria side that allowed them to get a point against Juventus, they are a very solid team, and I think it's one of those situations where we've expected them to drop off ever since they started the season fast, but they've now drawn with Juventus, they've drawn with Roma, they've drawn with Napoli. You begin to get the impression they're going to hang around. And I think that there's individual players. I think Manolo Gagliardini coming off the bench and scoring this weekend is a player that has been highly thought of in Italy for a long time and is beginning to live up to some of that potential. And perhaps that's a scary thought for Sampdoria because actually there's strong rumours that he's going to be on his way in January and probably to Napoli. There's obviously him Stefan Okaka up front is having an excellent season leading the line. Not scoring as many goals as I would like to see him score, but he certainly does a good job of holding the ball up and bringing others into play. And I do think that Denisa Mihailovic is also just really proving himself as a manager this season. He's sort of it's not his first job. You know, we've seen him not do so well at Fiorentina. We've seen him struggle in other places, but he seems to be learning as he goes, and he seems to be genuinely developing into a good manager. And certainly the one thing you have to say with his teams is they work hard, and they have an incredible drive about them, which is the same thing you would have said about Antonio Conte's Juventus teams. The manager just manages to get his personality into the players. So I think that there's lots of elements to it, but he's certainly a big one.
Well, Sampdoria isn't that big a surprise, given the talent they have. Can you explain Genoa to us? You know, what a fantastic season so far. Tied with Sampdoria and Lazio for third place. I know they lost this past weekend, but what a wonderful story.
Yeah, I mean, that one certainly come up as a big surprise, I think, to lots of us. And also because of Genoa, it's one of these weird teams where they they're going to change about half the squad every single summer. So it's hard to ever expect any kind of stability. You've got a manager there in Gasperini who I think you can say has for a very long time been very good at dealing with that. When he's been at Genoa, he's been the guy who's actually been able to succeed despite this tendency of Preziosi to turn the squad over. He's been the one who's actually been versatile enough to deal with it. I think having a great goalkeeper like Mattia Perin clearly helps. He's having a phenomenal start to the season, and that's certainly a part of it. But you can take that out of it, and the fact that he got sent off at the weekend, and Eugenio Lamanna, who's not played in Serie A before, comes on and saves a penalty, suggests that maybe it's not just about that's just about saving a penalty, obviously, but not just the goalkeeper that's keeping them in it, because the team then put up a really good fight and were possibly unfortunate to lose to Roma. So I don't know. I think they've got a good defense. I think they've got a few interesting players coming through, but again, it feels like a victory for the manager more than any sort of one or two players that you could single out and say, well, he's a tremendous player who we're going to be, aside from Perrin, talking about as the future of Italian football.
We're talking to The Guardian's Paolo Bandini here on the Soccer Central podcast. Paolo, for me, one of the more interesting developments this year has been the play of Jeremy Menez at AC Milan in his return to Serie A. I think it's fair to say he's probably been one of the bright spots for the Rossoneri. But is this more of a statement of how good he is, or is it more of a reflection of just how mediocre Milan is?
I think he's taken the role on in a very interesting way, a very impressive way. With Menez, we've been talking about him forever as a guy who's got lots of talent. I don't think anyone doubted when he went to PSG that he was a player who had lots of ability. It's just that he's never really put it together in any sort of consistent way.
Right.
I think it's certainly a mark of where Juventus are, where Milan are, that they're able to let him be the guy at the moment. I think in the past, better Milan teams would not have had room for him. They would have had to move him around, have him playing on the left and the right, have him in and out of the team. And maybe, actually, the thing that Menez needed, and maybe it's also a question of the age he is and the point he is at in his career, but maybe what he needed was someone to have the faith in him to say, right, lead the line, do it, be our guy. And he is finally getting that, and so far he's responding to it very well. I think I think it doesn't necessarily reflect badly on Milan that he's doing that, because he's scoring goals. What reflects worse on Milan is the fact that they haven't been able to integrate a guy like Torres, and the fact that defense still ultimately looks utterly unreliable, even though it had a pretty decent game this weekend.
Yeah, beating Napoli 2-0, of course. Pippo Inzaghi, the old story is that him and the owner get on so well he can never be fired, which might be a bit of a stretch because, anyone can get fired in this game. But you mentioned how Torres has struggled so far this year, and you think that having a manager who scored all those goals as Super Pippo scored, there might be a good fit there. How has he been so far, and is there any way he can salvage Torres' career?
I certainly think we can just to double back on what you said. I certainly think we can not take it too far with the can't get fired, because look, Seedorf was a huge a guy that Berlusconi loved. He was a player that Berlusconi was a huge fan of, and that Berlusconi had singled out years before he retired as someone who was going to be manager and be manager of Milan. So it's not like Berlusconi will make will never go back on those decisions. I do think that what Inzaghi's doing is being smart and knowing just how far to let Berlusconi feel like he is in control without completely letting him be in control, which I think Seydorf was much worse at. I think Seydorf pretty much just didn't let Berlusconi step in, and you kind of have to know how to play that politically. As for Torres, I find it a tricky one because, you know, he's just looked so not involved in this team, and I was struggling to get to the bottom of it a little while ago. I went and had a look at some of the numbers, and it's what I found was that actually his accuracy, his shooting accuracy, has been way down at Milan compared to even where it was in the latter less successful years at Chelsea, which to me speaks of a lack of confidence, a lack of feeling settled where you are, and that's something that at least seems like it could improve. The problem is that giving him a run in the team or giving him that opportunity is hard to do at the moment because every time he comes into the team, the whole shape of what Milan are trying to do looks far more stilted. I think that El Shaarawy, although he didn't start the weekend, I think El Shaarawy is a player who seems to benefit more when Menez is there because Menez moves more and comes outside, and that gives El Shaarawy opportunity to cut in. And the whole team just is more fluid with Menez. And so I think that there is a problem with how to deal with Torres. In that to fix it, you need to give him a run. But how do you give him a run when you're chasing third place and it's not working?
The other Milan team, Inter Milan, up against Chievo later today, currently in 12th place. Roberto Mancini is once again on the sidelines, 1-5 overall since returning to Inter Milan. Are you used to seeing him there yet? Was that a clever hire or a very predictable hire?
I was predictable because I didn't see it coming until quite soon before we had the reports. I think it was a situation where even Inter didn't believe he would come back until they got some information that he might, and they leapt on it. I don't know. It's a difficult one for me because they're still paying Walter Mazzarri because this is what always happens in Italy. No one ever gets fired; they get kept on, and the hope that eventually another club will come in and take those wages off the bill. So they're still paying Walter Mazzarri more than €3 million a year. They're playing Mancini the equivalent of €4 million a year, and that's now a huge amount of money you have invested in your manager, and a huge pressure on Mancini to deliver at that price. Because if he doesn't deliver now, then you really haven't got any other options at all. What else can you do? Just sack him again and bring in someone else?
It is a Serie A, Palos. Gardening leave, you know.
but to me, it is a big gamble because I think there's better ways that money could have been spent. And I don't think that what we've seen so far has been hugely impressive. But yeah, it is still very early doors. He came in into an incredibly difficult start with Roma and Milan in his first two games. He's going to have this winter break now to sort things out. Obviously, they're playing Chievo this evening, so that maybe they'll get a win there and things will pick up a little bit. But I think the winter break is going to be the crucial time for Mancini to put his imprint on this team. The question is how much they're going to be able to spend, because Inter turned a vast loss in the last 12 months. They are on UEFA's radar as a team that needs to get its house in order for financial fair play. And Fahir has been in Nihon speaking to UEFA about this, and I don't know how he could justify going out and spending more money. But when you have a new manager, obviously they want to get some of their own players in, so I'm sure they're going to try. It'll be very interesting to see how they come out in January and what that team looks like. But I think it was financially a bit of a dangerous gamble, personally, on Mancini.
One of my favorite players, Antonio Di Natale, continues to shine for Udinese, currently ranked second in league scoring behind Carlos Tevez with 8 goals, and recently netted his 200th Serie A goal. Amazingly, 37 years old. How much longer can he go, Paolo?
I want to say forever. John. I don't want this to end.
No, neither do I.
I love Di Natale. You know, he's probably, we don't talk about, I'm not trying to talk about best players or the players who I think have done the most incredible things that I've watched on a football pitch, but he is one of the players I've most enjoyed watching on a football pitch because he's just one of those guys who you can see enjoys himself so much, and that's always just more fun. It's more fun to watch someone who looks like they're enjoying themselves. And I don't know. You know, he was ready to retire last season when things were going not so well, and he talked about that in an interview not that long ago. He said, you know, his father was unwell. His father actually passed away quite recently,
right.
He had the fans getting on his back because, you know, they weren't doing well, and all of these things just added up. And he thought, I don't need this. I don't need to be being booed and jeered because the team aren't doing well, and it's not fun anymore. And he told everyone he was retiring. Obviously, that was in January, and by the end of the season, things had turned around again, and he was having fun, so he kept going. I think that's really all there is to it, probably, for him at this point of his career. It's not like there's any particular goal he has in mind. He's never going to win the league with Udinese. He's almost certainly never going to get back in the Champions League with Udinese. He's not going back in the Italy team, so he's only going to be there as long as he enjoys scoring goals and he keeps scoring them. At the moment, he seems to be doing that, so I guess we'll find out at the end of the season if he fancies another go-around, but I'm like you, John. I hope it goes as long as it can.
No, I totally agree. Is there any chance that he might sort of follow Marco Di Vaio's example and try MLS?
Never say never, but he's not a guy who strikes me as an obvious candidate because he is a real homebody. He's someone right. who, when they talk about why he didn't leave Udinese, why he didn't go to a bigger team, a big part of that comes down to the fact that he likes his life where he is. I always go back to the story that when he first went to Empoli, he grew up in Naples, and he first went to Empoli as a teenager. He basically was in their academy for a couple of nights and he ran home. He sort of slipped out and fled because he got homesick. And I think every move in his life has been sort of semi-traumatic for him, and he managed to find a community he liked in Udinese, and that's why, in Udinese, and he just didn't want to leave after that. And I think that he's got a plan to retire, and he's going to go back to Empoli, where he still has a house, and that's where I think his family's going to be. But I'm sure he'll be present lots at Udinese as well. I wouldn't be surprised if he gets a job upstairs at Udinese. I would expect him to go to America, but you never know. Sometimes, maybe if it's even just for 1 year, sometimes people get a thought that something might be fun. But he's not an obvious candidate for me.
Toto would score, I think, about 1,000 goals if he came to MLS for a year. I'd love to see that. Love it. Paolo, thanks so much, mate. Great to chat again, and we'll talk to you soon, hopefully.
Yeah, see you soon, guys.
Thanks, Paolo.
It's Paolo Bandini. You can follow Paolo at Paolo_Bandini. You can catch his work in The Guardian, SoccerNet, everywhere, basically.
Great writer.
He's everywhere. He's fantastic. John. That's the end of today's show and our last Monday podcast for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, we're taking 2 weeks off starting next week, so James and I won't be back till, I think, January 5th, whatever
the Monday is. Yeah, the 5th, the Monday after New Year's.
James is going away and I'm taking time off, so you're going to have to live without us. But
I'm sure they'll be okay.
Yes.
Probably actually be a better Monday for them without
That's
us.
That's true. And James and Brendan and Thomas Dobby are going to be back on this Thursday to record another edition of Soccer Central.
Well, your mic's dying.
Is it?
Yeah, you better hurry up.
Oh, there you go. Well, okay, I'll end this quick then. That's it for another edition of the Soccer Central podcast. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk soon.